Outstanding. Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Court of Appeals for our next hearing in the matter of the State of Minnesota versus Frederick Heidman, case number A230858. Is each of you familiar with our Zoom procedures and format?
Yes, Your Honors.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Excellent. Each of you should state your name before each leg of the argument so we know who's speaking for the audio recording that's made available to the public. We'll now hear from counsel for appellant.
Edward Shaw for appellant Frederick Heidman. May it please the court, counsel. Appellant was convicted of disorderly conduct for walking up to a police officer and expressing his opinion to that officer. Appellant was at the end of a row of several squad cars, some distance away from a car that had been stopped earlier by law enforcement.
Could you remind us where this happened? I know it was in Nisswa, but where?
Oh, thank you. This was south of Nisswa on Highway 371. So it was actually in the city limits of Nisswa, south of the downtown.
Right at the curb by the lake?
It's a curve by a lake. You're familiar
I
with the
know
area.
It well. All right, go ahead.
Thank you. And it was in the southbound lane, so the vehicles were all facing south, heading away from downtown Nisswa. And the officers, both the officer who Mr. Heidman encountered and the other officer at the scene, testified they didn't at any time feel threatened in any way by appellant. Didn't have to, take any ad. They didn't feel threatened. At the end of the discussion with Officer Thompson, appellant left on his own accord. Officer Thompson, other officers went about their business, continued with the traffic stop. Mr. Heidman walked back to his business, which is located on the other side of 371, on the northbound side, just south of where the traffic stop is. He could actually see the traffic stop from his business at one point and was pointing to his business during his encounter with Officer Thompson. And the state in its brief appears to concede that the conviction can only be justified by appellant's actions, not by appellant's speech. So I will focus on appellant's actions as well. And, there simply weren't any actions on the part of appellant that could justify a conviction for disorderly conduct. But unlike the cases cited by counsel for the state, State v. Carnes, matter of TLS, appellant was not engaging in behavior which was disruptive, which prevented a school or another institution from going about their...
Was this behavior disruptive to the traffic stop and the officers attempting to engage with the individual who was stopped?
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. And the evidence showed that it was not, that Mr. Heidman was, I think there were three cars parked behind the vehicle and was stopped. Mr. Heidman's encounter relevant to this case was with Officer Thompson, who was not the primary officer. The traffic stop kind of what seemed appear to continue unimpacted by Mr. Heidman. Mr. Heidman didn't have any impact with the drivers of the vehicle.
I don't know. It seemed, from my view of the body worn camera, it looks like the officer, in fact, had to repeatedly ask your client to move out of the way for his safety. And part of managing that traffic stop was to, take care of, to make sure no one is going to be injured, because this happened on a highway where cars were going by at highway speed, correct?
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. And Officer Thompson did ask Mr. Heidman to leave and cited safety. But that, in an officer requesting someone to leave a public place, the person's failure to leave doesn't mean they're guilty of disorderly conduct.
Well, but he just said, get back and get out of the way so that you will be safe. Didn't that disrupt his ability to otherwise manage that traffic stop?
Well, Officer Thompson didn't testify. I think he testified that his duties were not interfered with. The traffic stop was not impacted by his interaction with Mr. Heidman. Mr. Heidman ended up leaving. He went back across the highway.
The traffic stop wasn't interrupted necessarily directly, but if an officer's job is to make the area safe, for the officer who's making the stop, for the individual who's stopped, and for any bystanders, it seems to me that your client put himself in a position that required the officer to direct him to move to a safe position. And your client refused to do so, requiring the officer to remain engaged with your client. Correct me if I'm wrong about that. And if I'm right, Why isn't that enough for a jury to conclude that, I mean, the jury might have reached a different conclusion, but why isn't that enough for a jury to conclude that that's disorderly conduct under the definition of the statute, the conduct-based definition of the statute?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. And certainly the video shows that Officer Thompson was, for a pretty brief period of time, engaged with Mr. Hydeman before Mr. Hydeman ended up leaving. But I would submit that an officer having to engage with someone and someone not doing what an officer wants doesn't in itself add up to disorderly conduct. If that standard were to be applied, then every situation where an officer told someone to leave for whatever reason, the person didn't immediately agree with the officer, they would be guilty of disorderly conduct. I think we have to look at the facts of each situation.
Well, if an individual were to disobey a lawful police order, to remove himself from the scene that the officer believes is necessary to be protected, not necessary for individuals to leave to protect the officer and others, to make sure that they're safe and not distracted. I mean, that would certainly lend itself to a different charge, obstruction, but just because it meets the definition of one statute doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't meet the definition of another. I'm not sure why you can't charge one or the other.
And Your Honor, respectfully, I would, irregardless of whether it meets the definition of obstruction or not, which obviously isn't the issue we're here for, I would submit that it does not in itself meet the definition of disorderly conduct. That if we were to accept that definition, then officers could order members of the public to leave any public place at any time. I think we have to look at the circumstances of each situation.
I think that's a stretch, isn't it? Not leave any public place at any public time. Leave an area that's around a traffic stop within a zone that the officer believes is necessary to maintain free of individuals in order to protect the area, in order to protect the officers from any concerns of risk of harm, including to your client who was near the public roadway and your client's dog who apparently went onto the public's roadway.
Yeah. And this is 371. This is 50 miles an hour or 55 miles an hour where this happened.
Oh, it was, Your Honor.
On a curved stretch of road, traffic both directions, officer pulled over to the side. We have laws requiring people to move over away from officers so they don't get hit on the side of the road during traffic stops. And your client's crossing the highway with a dog to swear at the officers, refuses their direction to step back, which presumably was intended for his own safety, and the dog gets loose. I mean, he was creating a hazard. Isn't that disorderly?
Oh, Your Honor, I would submit that Mr. Hydeman was well back from where the traffic stop was occurring the entire time. His dog getting off the leash was not intentional. I don't think we can find a dog getting off of a leash, which was quickly put back on the leash, as disorderly conduct. That was, by any account, not an intentional act.
I mention it as one of the many circumstances you're suggesting we need to look at, just in terms of the big picture of what was going on here and what your client was doing. I mean, this is far different than, an arrest in an area on a street corner where it's all pedestrians and someone starts filming and interacting with the police officers. This is on the side of a busy highway that creates a risk to everyone involved. Does that matter?
Well, I think location matters, but even an arrest on a street, there would still be cars going by. There's still activity. I mean, Mr. Hydeman was not in the traffic lanes. I think merely standing for a short period of time in the fog lane of the roadway is, I would submit, that's not in itself disorderly conduct. Or we're going to there that a lot of people engage in those actions, and I don't think that's.
But he's unnecessarily causing a distraction on the side of the road, both to the officers and to people who are driving by. It's just behavior that's inexplicable, quite frankly.
Well, he was the mayor of the city. The officers are essentially his employees. He was the mayor of that city.
That's not so. The officers.
No, they're county officers. Yeah. Sorry.
They were, with all due respect, they were City of Nisswa. The City of Nisswa police officers. Officer Thompson was City of Nisswa.
So are you suggesting that under the arrangement of the city's government structure, that the mayor is directly in control of police officers and their duties, and he's acting as a in lieu of a police chief, giving directions to the officers? Exactly is your argument in that regard?
He's certainly not. There was a police chief in the city of Nisswa.
What's his role on the scene? Is he acting in his role as a supervisor of police, or is he acting as a citizen challenging the officer's conduct in deciding to make a traffic stop?
Well, he's acting as a citizen and as the mayor of the city, questioning how policing is done in his city within his
Does the mayor have some special privilege that supersedes the disorderly conduct statute? If the mayor is acting in a manner that's disorderly, is there some special provision that you think causes some immunity from prosecution under the statute? What's your argument?
The mayor has the same rights and obligations as everybody else, but I would submit that if we're in a situation where the mayor of a city can't critique police operating within that city, I think that raises some serious issues with the democratic process and how, and ultimately, civilian control of law enforcement in this country. I think that does raise issues.
Are you not concerned that there's a time, place, and manner element to when a citizen, mayor or otherwise, expresses a challenge to police and their decision to make a traffic stop?
Well, I think there certainly are times and places for everything, but I think the First Amendment is, there certainly can be reasonable time and place and manner restrictions, but I think we have to be, if we're going to say that no one can ever challenge law enforcement making an arrest or a traffic stop, I think that's not what the statute intends. I think that's frankly would be a dangerous precedent.
I think the charge was that it was a disruption, not a question. Well, again, I think we're talking about, I think perhaps a stray point, because as I understand it, the state concedes that the conduct is what's at issue here, not the content of the what your client was expressing.
Well, understood, Your Honor. That was certainly my understanding as well. And Mr. Heidman left of his own accord. And if the officers had felt threatened or endangered, they some other action would have been taken. Officer Thompson could have arrested Mr. Heidman then and there. That didn't happen. There was a brief encounter. It didn't impact the traffic stop. No officer testified that impacted the traffic stop in any way or interfered with the performance of their duties. Mr. Heidman spoke his piece and he left. And I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that Mr. Heidman would not have been charged if he had come over and said, good job, guys, doing a great job. I blacked the blue. It was a criticism that got him arrested.
If your client came over and said, hey, good job, I like what you're doing, and the officer said, you're causing a danger, back away from the scene, and your client reacted by saying, good job, officers, nice job, but refuses to back away. I think the conduct is what's at issue here. I'm not, the hypothetical of what the officer would have done under different circumstances is, I don't think, really a basis for us to reach a reversal. I think it's based only on the facts of this case.
And I would certainly submit that if either officer felt like they were being interfered with in some way, that Mr. Heidman was a problem, they could have removed him from the scene. They could have put the cuffs on him. There were multiple officers there, multiple vehicles, not just the primary officer handling the traffic stop. They could have put the cuffs on him.
Why should an officer have to do that? Why isn't it enough for an officer just to tell someone to move away if the officer feels that the individual is threatening the integrity of the space for the traffic stop?
And Mr. Heidman did move away, Your Honor. I don't think it's disorderly conduct that Mr. Heidman didn't, immediately move away on the double quick, so to speak, but he did move away pretty soon after the encounter started.
Didn't he move away, though, and then come back and start talking with the subject of the traffic stop?
I don't believe that's part of the record, Your Honor. I don't believe that was argued at the trial. I don't believe that was part of the record. The base of the charge.
So there wasn't testimony indicating that he left and came back.
I believe the base of the conviction was the encounter with Officer Thompson. That any further incidents were not part of the record, as I understood it.
You have a little under a minute left. Do you have any other comments you'd like to make before we hear from counsel for the state? You, of course, will have your 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that these were city police officers. One was the city of Nisswa. One was Pequot Lakes, who was on a cooperative arrangement with the city of Nisswa. So at the time of the trial, Officer Jorgens was with the Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office. But at the time, the relevant time of the incident, he was, I believe, with the Pequot Lakes Police Department cooperatively working with Nisswa, just to set just that so, record straight.
Just so we're clear on the record, I think Judge Larkin was referring to the judge's findings in the district court, where the judge said defendant returned to the scene shortly thereafter and began speaking with the occupants of the stopped vehicle. So somehow the district court incorporated that into the findings. So I guess we'll hear from the state as to whether there's a record basis for that. I assume so, if the district court made that finding.
Thank you.
All right, we'll hear from counsel for the state. Would you introduce yourself for the record before proceeding with your argument?
I can. Michael Hagley, St. Louis County Attorney, or Assistant St. Louis County Attorney, appearing as conflict counsel for the Crow Wing County Attorney's Office. And so I guess before I begin my argument, Mr. Shaw is correct that the exhibit of the body camera or squad camera of Mr. Heidman returning to the stop was not placed in front of the jury at the trial. I believe that was a record made by the presiding judge in one of the two motions to dismiss. I believe the record presented to the jury, there may have been testimony to the effect that he returned, but there was not the footage of the return was not played.
So this was just in the motion to dismiss?
I believe so, Your Honor. Without having the benefit of the entire record before me, that is my recollection. May it please the court. The appellant in this case raises four issues in their brief, but I think that at the heart of this appeal and what it boils down to is a disagreement with the jury's verdict and a contention that there is insufficient evidence to support that verdict. As the court is aware, the standard of review here when examining the verdict of a jury is that the court is restricted to a careful analysis of the record in determining whether or not there was evidence when supported in the light most favorable to the verdict supports that verdict. And so, Your Honor, I guess here there was a case where Mr. Heidman approached a traffic stop along a busy highway. I believe there was testimony to the effect that the speed limit on that stretch of highway is 60 miles per hour and that vehicles and cars frequently go faster. He was asked to step back. The reason that was identified by the officers was that of officer safety and the safety of Mr. Heidman himself. Mr. Heidman responded by cursing loudly and approaching within feet of the officer, pointed in the officer's face, gesturing sharply. While this was happening, Mr. Heidman's dog was straining at its lead. The officer had to intervene to prevent the dog from getting into the lane of traffic. And again, all of this is occurring while traffic is going by at 60 miles per hour or above. The position of the state is that, and the position that was presented to the jury, is that Mr. Heidman's conduct was the basis for this conviction.
And part of that conduct was his boisterous speech and yelling and noise. I mean, there's a speech component to this conduct, is there not?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that the Mr. Heidman's approach, what he said during the approach, the volume of his voice, the body language, it is all, I guess, part of the package of this disorderly conduct. The state's position is that Mr. Heidman's approach, while cursing, while being loud, while sort of aggressively posturing at the officers, and while interfering with that traffic stop, is sufficient to support a conviction for a conduct-based disorderly conduct.
So I don't think it's been argued precisely this way, but on the jury instruction, and again, I don't see this exact argument in the appellant's presentation, but when I look at the jury instruction, the jury was instructed, if you find the defendant's conduct consisted only of offensive, abusive, or obscene language, you must also find that the words were fighting words. The problem with that, as I see it, is that if the state was arguing, as the state did argue, that there was more than just words, there wasn't just the language, it was conduct. There was the boisterous nature of the presentation, the confrontation of the officers walking across the highway, not backing away when told to back away, the volume, all of that. Seems to be the basis, but then the district court says, if you instructed the jury, if you find that conduct consisted only of offensive language, then you have to find that they're fighting words. Well, if I'm a juror, I might say, well, the state argued that it's not only the language, so we can consider the language, even if it's not fighting words, if it's abusive language or language that might cause someone to be resentful. Language that is clearly protected by the First Amendment. Again, I don't see that it may not be that this is the specific argument on the instructions, but what's the state's position about whether that instruction is accurate?
And Your Honor, I believe the case law surrounding disorderly conduct, I believe, does support a jury being allowed to examine a mixture of conduct and speech. And
certainly that's true, but it's one thing to say, if any part of your decision about disorderly conduct is based upon language, it has to also be fighting words. I think that would be accurate. But in this case, the court said, if you find that the conduct consisted only of language, then you have to find that it's also fighting words. If I'm a juror, I might say, well, it wasn't only language. It was also his boisterous, the volume and his demeanor and his gesturing. So we don't have to find fighting words. That troubled me more than I think the arguments that were presented about the challenge to the jury instruction, frankly.
Understood, Your Honor. I guess the...
Do you agree that could be misleading?
What I would say is that I think in a vacuum, yes. But the way that this case was presented and argued to the jury, presented the jury with a stark difference between, is this a conduct-based disorderly conduct or is this a speech-based disorderly conduct? And if it is speech-based, you must factor in his First Amendment rights. Mr. Shaw, I think, capably, presented that argument to the jury during closing arguments. The state, presented, I guess, the opposite argument that this was a conduct-based disorderly conduct. And those were sort of the two choices presented to the jury.
Were there any fighting words?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Were there any fighting words?
Not from the state's position. I don't believe so, Your Honor.
When I read the record, I don't see it either. I'm just wondering why during the prosecution stage, the state didn't just remove all the language. Just make it really clear that this is not a case about language at all. And why even talk about fighting words if that's not what the basis of the charge is, and that's not the basis of the conviction? And I agree with you. There's certainly some nasty words or some offensive words, but I didn't see any fighting words either.
And so is the court referring to the jury instruction or, I guess, the language in the charging document itself?
I'm referring to the language. I'm presenting it in the language in the charging document. And I think the closing argument might have also suggested that language was part of it, that fighting words may have been a part of it, but I could be wrong about that.
And Your Honor, what I can tell the court is that the fighting words instruction was requested on behalf of the defense. So the fighting word instruction in those jury instructions was a request of Mr. Heidman through his attorney that be presented to the jury.
And that's the district court used the standard crim jig for the instruction, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But and again, I don't have the benefit of the record for me, but my recollection is that the fighting words portion of the instruction and the portion of the jury instruction with regard to freedom of speech was specifically requested by Mr. Heidman. If I'm misremembering, if I'm incorrect, I invite Mr. Shaw to correct. But that was my recollection of what occurred during those jury instruction conferences. And so again, Your Honor, again, to
ask one other question about, so
of course,
usually in the case, and I was on the SLA case that, or the TLS case that both parties are citing. And that was a case that was loud. It was in a school setting. So the fact that it was loud mattered. There's a clear disorderly, there's disruption. Here you're on the side of the highway. Who is it who, besides the police officers, who might have been disturbed by the volume? And is it enough for police officers to be disturbed by the volume in order to justify a charge of disorderly conduct?
Well, and Your Honor, again, the state's position was that it was and is that the volume of the of Mr. Heidman's speech is but a factor. It's not the sole basis for the disorderly conduct conviction. It is one of many. It is the combination.
That's what I'm trying to get at. How is it a factor if only police are within earshot?
Well, Your Honor, I think as the court pointed out in Mr. Shaw's questioning, there were individuals other than police present. The occupants of that stopped vehicle were standing on the side of the road within earshot of Mr. Heidman. So the state's position here is that these were all of Mr. Shaw's arguments, the freedom of speech, these are not fighting words. All of this was presented to the jury during closing arguments, during the trial, and the jury rejected those arguments. The state's request is that
the jury rejected the arguments about, I thought you were conceding that the content of the speech was protected by the First Amendment.
Yes, Your Honor. And Mr. Shaw argued to the jury that this was speech based only, that it was protected by Mr. Heidman's freedom of speech, that it was not fighting words. If I misspoke earlier and I indicated that there was an argument that fighting words were present, I apologize. But all of the arguments in Mr. Shaw's brief, with the exception of, I guess, the jury instructions, were presented to the jury, and the jury declined to go along with Mr. Shaw or with Mr. Heidman's reasoning. So that's the request of the state, is that the court leave the verdict undisturbed and decline to invade the providence of the jury. If there are any other questions of
well,
the court.
Here, okay, so this was, I think, your words, arguing to the court with regard to the jury instructions. I would ask that those stay in. I think that they are in here, that the language that is directly from the statute, and again, and here's the part that I was a little concerned about, the state's theory of the case is that Mr. Heidman's conduct, when combined with his language, was such that it would tend to arouse fear or alarm in others. So, and that's, you know, where it makes sense to me that if the case is only about the conduct, it'd only be about the conduct, but it seems like the argument was from the state's position in the trial was that it was conduct and language, not just conduct. Correct me if I'm wrong. This wasn't the argument to the jury. I'm pointing out the argument that was made to the court at the time that the jury instructions were being debated.
And Your Honor, I confess that I do not recall saying that. It has been some time since the trial, and I have participated in many trials since. Sure. What I would tell the court is that the argument as presented to the jury did not, I guess, implicate Mr. Heidman's freedom of speech from the state's perspective. The state's argument to the jury, who is ultimately the finder of fact, was that this was a conduct-based disorderly conduct.
Thank you for that.
If the court has no further questions, I would yield the remainder of my time.
I don't see any questions, so we'll hear now from Appellant's counsel on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I just pulled up the transcript, and it sounds like you're on it, but the discussion on the jury instructions appeared to start around page 192 of the transcript. And I believe counsel for the state had clarified this, but there, in motions to dismiss, there was discussion of Mr. Heidman coming back. The evidence presented at trial was only the first encounter. There was no evidence presented in trial as to any other actions of Mr. Heidman after he went back to his business. Just wanted to make sure to set the record straight on that. And the amount of the time in question, so to speak, was a very brief encounter, as shown in the video, when Mr. Heidman was engaging with Officer Thompson. It was quite short, and Mr. Heidman, again, left of his own accord. He didn't leave immediately when Officer Thompson asked him to. I certainly will concede that, but I would respectfully submit that merely not obeying an order of a police officer is not by itself enough for disorderly conduct, that the court has to make an independent determination as to a defendant was putting somebody in danger and harm in some way, that merely, respectfully, we're not a police state. We don't have to do what officers ask us to do on the double quick. And it's not a crime to not do that. Depends on the circumstances. Sometimes it is appropriate to criminalize not following an order. Other times it isn't. And we have to look at each situation differently. And Officer Thompson did not testify that he couldn't go about his duties. He was prevented from doing anything by Mr. Heidman being there. Officer Jorgens testified likewise. The traffic stop went ahead. There was no evidence that anybody heard or was disturbed by Mr. Heidman's statements. Mr. Heidman was multiple vehicles behind the people who were stopped in the traffic stop. There's no evidence that they heard anything, or that if they did, they were disturbed by it. I mean, the language Mr. Heidman used isn't the kind of language I would use, but people swear in this society quite a bit, and it's well established that, saying some unpleasant words in itself is not disorderly conduct. And it doesn't appear that anyone else heard them besides Officer Thompson, and there's certainly no evidence that if they did, they were offended. It's language that is out there quite a bit that most of us hear on a pretty regular basis. And if Mr. Heidman was somehow creating a danger or interfering with duties being completed or posing a threat of any kind, Officer Thompson was well equipped to deal with that. He testified. He was, he's in uniform. He's got all of his equipment. There would be no question about him handling Mr. Heidman if necessary. He didn't have to do that. Mr. Heidman left. The encounter ended. It was not a very lengthy encounter, and that was it. And nothing in that encounter was criminal in any way. Citizens express opinions, and how a society is policed is a pretty important issue now. This happened the summer that George Floyd was murdered. This was a couple months after that happened, and people need to be able to express opinions to officers, sometimes in a rather salty way, maybe in a not diplomatic way, but we have to provide an outlet for a peaceful expression of opinions not the language we choose, but peaceably. There weren't any threats involved. Mr. Heidman wasn't threatening anybody or challenging anyone to a fight. There's no fighting words. He spoke his piece. He left, and that was it. And we have
but
to allow
it. But doesn't it matter that he spoke his piece in a way that interfered with the officers in a situation that could have been dangerous for everyone involved? I mean, what you've just described makes perfect sense. If a letter is sent or a visit is made to the police station after the incident to discuss what was observed, but to go into the traffic stop, cross into the highway, refuse to leave, all of these other things, don't those facts take this beyond what you've just described as a peaceable expression of dissatisfaction with the way in which the police officer handled the traffic stop?
I would respectfully Say not, Your Honor, that if we say that a citizen, the only way a citizen can criticize law enforcement is to file a formal complaint down at the station, let the bureaucracy take its course, then no matter what law enforcement's doing, any citizen questioning of that is criminalized by nature. Arguably, someone going up to Derek Chauvin and telling him to stop strangling George Floyd would be criminalized because that person could have filed a complaint down at the station, filled out the proper form. People have to be able to express themselves, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The matter is submitted. You will have our decision within 90 days.